America Trends Podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. I'm Larry Rifkin. For a country that's been dominated by a white majority since its inception, recent events have taken some adjusting to. Barack Obama's ascendance to the presidency in 2009 was such an event. The recent confirmation of Judge Jackson to the U.S. Supreme Court, the first female black justice, was another. However, a demographic reality which was revealed in 2015 might have been a stunner for some. Whites in America will be a minority by 2044. It's hard to deny the impact of that fact on the same people rooting our last president on as he tried but failed to build a wall. Diverse America is a fact no one can deny, and everyone must come to terms with. We'll discuss it today on America Trends.
With us on America Trends is Justin Guest, and he's written a book called Majority Minority. And Justin, this is a fascinating and important topic, and one that probably informs a whole lot of what's going on in America today. For those who are confused about the politics and the division and the rancor, I think you really have nailed it in terms of some of the underlying causes for it. And you say that on March 3rd, 2015, that was the date for American social upheaval when it was being set. And that's because, of course, there was a finding by the U.S. Census. But in fact, I'm going to go back a little bit farther than that. But tell us why you pin that date as being so important.
Sure. Well, thanks so much for having me on your show, Larry. That was the date when the U.S. Census released a really well-publicized report that actually wasn't even focused on majority-minority transition that we're all thinking about now. But buried inside of it was a prediction that the United States would become a majority-minority country, a country in which white people make up a plurality, but a minority among other minorities in around 2044. And that date, you know, was basically became set in the minds of a lot of Americans for an enormous shift change in a way of not only thinking about the demography of the country, but about its identity as well.
When I look at it, I go back, well, I could go back a lot farther. I think I'm a lot older than you. And I could go back to Barry Goldwater. I could go back to the silent majority with Richard Nixon, Pat Buchanan, Newt Gingrich, and then I could go back to Barack Obama ascending as the first black president of the United States, January 20, 2009. And to me, I can pin a lot of what's happening today on that moment in time. Do you agree at all?
Absolutely. I think that Obama's presidency and Obama's election heralded a new generation of both leaders, but also the ascendance of people of minority backgrounds into the leadership of the country. And so I think that America became acutely aware of its minority demographics, and he obviously broke the ceiling off in terms of what, you know, members of ethnic and racial minorities could achieve. But I also think that there is some sort of sense of comfort in the idea that Americans would remain majority white, that, you know, the country that Obama was changing was fundamentally secure and stable. And while I think that, you know, Obama was certainly destabilizing for people who are concerned about that kind of future, I think that when the U.S. Census actually predicted and gave a date to when that's going to happen, it really made waves. It's interesting to note, though, that in the same year that Obama ran for president, the first census report on the majority minority future actually was released. it just didn't garner the same amount of publicity, probably because that future was still a good 35 years away. But 2044, you know, feels a lot closer now.
Absolutely. It's very interesting when you think about it, because the whole idea of a multiracial country that is a democracy is something that, I guess, for me, having been born in 1952, when I really became of an age where I was really conscious of what was going on, it didn't seem at all unusual to me. But really, it took effect in 1965 with the Voting Rights Act, because before that, there were so many impediments to voting, and blacks were kept in so many marginal ways in the democracy that it really never was a multiracial democracy fully until the Voting Rights Act. And now, of course, we see many attempts to push back on that. We've seen the Supreme Court water it down, and we see fights about it going on in state after state here in America today. So there's always been this push forward and this desire to pull back. And I guess there's no other way to describe what happened after Barack Obama to elect somebody who really had this nativist approach like Donald Trump.
No doubt there is an incredibly strong backlash that, you know, the combination of Obama's election, of increasing culture war politics that had really been brewing since the late 1990s, and of course that census report in changing the sort of orientation of the country, no doubt about it. And, you know, in countries that are multi-ethnic, you know, what, like the United States, you know, what the 1965 legislation thereafter did was it institutionalized the equality of minorities in the United States, particularly African Americans, who had long been subject to oppressive double standards. But what you then saw thereafter is the endurance of some of this discrimination, the endurance of prejudice in far more subtle forms. And what we're beginning to see is that with demographic change, the anticipation is that even those subtle forms are beginning to dissipate, or in some cases being protected all the more closely.
And we are not seeing this just in the United States. We're seeing this in Europe, a sharp growth in the number of foreign-born people coinciding with other major transformations in the late 20th century, the decline of manufacturing, economic shifts. I mean, talk about all of this in context.
Yeah, so we're not alone by any means. You know, the main comparative edge of the book is that I examine a variety of societies where a majority-minority transition has happened before. Most Americans think that this is the first one in history, and no doubt it's we're definitely the largest country to ever encounter such an enormous demographic shift, but we're not the only country to do so. But countries in Europe are structurally very similar to the United States in their demography, and that, you know, what you're seeing is countries that are subject to aging white populations with very low fertility rates. Almost all, if not all, population growth is coming from ethnic or racial or religious minorities that are entering those countries via immigration. And so what's naturally happening is that the demographic composition of these societies is being altered. Now, the European countries that we're thinking of, and also other settler states, you know, former settler states like Canada or Australia or New Zealand, these are all countries that are still behind the linear curve that is the United States. Our majority minority transition date is significantly sooner than most of those other countries, especially sooner than the European countries. But in many ways, the politics are not that different. The specter of demographic change is altering politics around the world.
You live in California, and there already this has taken place. You've got majority-minority status reached in California, New Mexico, and Texas, and I find it very interesting. I think it was 30 million people in that area that come from Mexico, even though there had been attempts to keep that population from growing. So tell us what we see if, in fact, you are on the front edge of the change that we're talking about.
Yeah, I actually don't live in California anymore. I grew up in California. I'm a Los Angeles by Angeleno by native, by nativity.
Okay.
And I certainly spend a lot of time there. I go back all the time. In many ways, I think that I was on the sort of front lines of this, though, growing up. You know, I went to schools, public schools in Los Angeles that were already majority minority schools way before the demographic trends, you know, nationally caught up. And, you know, I think that it's certainly one of the things that piqued my own interest in the subject matter. And so, you know, it's a little bit different at the state level or any kind of provincial level. And the reason why, of course, is that states cannot control their demography in the same way that the federal government can. The federal government has its fingers on the levers of immigration policy, which is really the greatest driver of our demographic change. And really, that's the lens that I would view much of the Trump administration's efforts on immigration as trying to affect. In many ways, they were sort of halting the demographic change that immigration bore. But, you know, at the state level, you know, you can certainly engage in a lot of multicultural policies, the kind of policies of integration and inclusion that actually make members of ethnic minorities or immigrants more comfortable and more of an equal status to people who are native born. But it's really the federal government that has all the levers when it comes to managing demography.
Now, you say that natives, no matter the integration of ethnic minorities and immigrants, and by the way, it's hard to call us natives when we think about how the lands were appropriated. We are the settlers in many ways, but nonetheless, for this purpose, and that we still perceive the minorities and the immigrants to be different. And so as much as we think there's an assimilation going on, there is still, and you pointed out in so many ways in your book, that there's still a way that we try to define community in a more limited sense. And let me take us back to the 2020 election, when we note that there were these questions about the appropriateness and the legitimacy of the election. It was in places like Philadelphia and Milwaukee and places that were minority majority, and it wasn't in rural areas. So, in fact, it's a questioning of the legitimacy of those votes versus the other votes.
Yeah, I mean the sort of double standard created by, you know, the allegations of election rigging by former President Donald Trump all surrounded Democratic leaning areas, because strategically those are the votes he was hoping to negate or to counter. And so, you know, yes, those areas happen to be, you know, very demographically diverse. In many ways, though, what that reflects to me is actually the increasing racialization of American politics. You know, there was a time not so long ago when the votes of many ethnic and racial minorities in the United States were really up for grabs. They were split. You know, Asian Americans voted 55% for George H.W. Bush in 1992. Latinos actually voted 44% for George W. Bush in 2004. Muslim Americans leaned towards George W. Bush in 2000 before the 2001 terrorist attacks and the war on terror. So, you know, these are all minority groups that actually went Republican over the course of the last, you know, generation or two. But these days, you know, effectively, the Republican Party now is about 83% white in terms of its support. And almost all ethnic minorities now and racial minorities in the United States and non-Christian religious minorities, almost all of them lean heavily towards the Democratic Party. And so that is, you know, that is not a great thing for democracy going forward, when basically our partisan identities overlap or are subsumed by our personal identities in such a way. It makes people see the partisan opponents as an existential threat, as a threat to their group, to their group-based status. And that makes people less willing to follow the rules and to trust in social institutions and when the other side is in charge. And it leads people to want to be more inclined to break the rules in order to win.
When you look at that, is that an opening then for somebody who does see past this particular era of the Republican Party to say, gee, we were making inroads before? We look at the demography, and some say demography is destiny, and we better start making some shifts in the way that we are approaching issues and these minorities who are growing in such numbers and impact across America. Is that possible?
Well, as recently as the 2012 postmortem for the Republican Party after Mitt Romney lost his bid for the White House to Barack Obama, the Republican postmortem basically noted this and said, you know, we are losing because we are not keeping up with demographic trends that are severely against us. you know, our supporters trend older, they trend whiter, they trend more rural, they said at the time. And, you know, all of those are shrinking subgroups in American demography. And they urged the RNC at the time to really start making inroads with more ethnic and racial minority groups. Before that, in the 2004 election, Karl Rove was known to be actively courting the Latino vote because he believed that Latino social conservatism actually matched very closely with the kind of conservatism that he and George W. Bush were espousing at the time. And he was really inspired to do this by his, you know, time and experience in Texas politics, where there were a lot of Latino conservatives. And sure enough, they won 44% of the Latino vote nationwide, as I mentioned earlier. And so, you know, these conversations have been sort of echoing in the corridors of the Republican Party for some time. But each time, I think you have seen presidential elections and national level statewide elections take place, most Republican candidates have found it far more convenient to simply engage in the kind of culture wars and social politics that subtly or not so subtly castigate, you know, ethnic minorities and racial minorities in the United States and scapegoat them for a lot of the nation's problems. And so it's just been a failure of sort of long-term thinking that has led us to kind of spiral downward into this rut of culture wars that really divide the country partisan-wise on racial and ethnic lines.
Yet the Democrats might be a little overconfident that, in fact, destiny is theirs, and thus not really make the attempts that they need to solidify whatever that growing majority that they have is. And, of course, the GOP, they look at it as demise, gloom, fear, and they're using that for some temporal victories in certain places using gerrymandering and other techniques, but that cannot hold off for the long term, the inevitability of the change that we're seeing. So I guess my question is, because you point out in the book how important it is as we begin to redefine community in America. I mean, what do we have to do as a society, given that we're on the front edge of this change? Perhaps no one has attempted it in the way that America is. I mean, what are the imperatives to try to bring us back into from many come one? I mean, what do we have to do?
Well, there's a lot to unpack in that question. Let's just take each party one at a time, and then we can talk about what we need to do as a nation. So you're absolutely right, Larry. So the Republican Party right now is contorting a lot of electoral institutions to their advantage as much as possible. So whether it's through partisan gerrymandering, you know, leveraging any kind of advantage in terms of voting rights, you know, they're basically trying to pass laws that lean toward their advantage electorally. And they already are advantaged from the perspective of how power is divvied up by the Electoral College and by the Senate, which obviously advantages more sparsely populated states by giving them outsized power inside of the Senate chamber. And so, yes, you're seeing a lot of contortions there, and I do think they would be served well to actually do more outreach to ethnic and racial minority groups. On the Democrat side, I do think there's also a lot of complacency. You know, yes, there was this sort of phrase that was echoing through Washington, D.C. for a while, particularly after Obama's election, that demography is destiny. But the problem with, of course, the idea that demography is destiny is that, first off, you're assuming that the political preferences of different demographic subgroups are static, that they don't change with time and with experience in the United States. And it also presumes that you don't actually have to evolve yourself as a party to keep up with those trends. It's a very complacent approach. Demography is inevitable, but that doesn't mean that people follow in the same way. We are, you know, creative and evolving minds out there. And so, you know, the Democratic Party was always going to have to compete for votes and could not rest on certain demographic subgroups' laurels or their laurels with those demographic subgroups. Furthermore, the Democratic Party could not survive by redlining enormous amounts of white and white working class voters. You know, white working class voters who used to be the backbone of the Democratic Party, you know, two generations ago, they still make up about, you know, depending on how you measure it, 33 to 40% of the country, of the electorate. 70% of the electorate remains white because of higher voting rates among white Americans. And so any strategy electorally that ignores white voters or at least makes them feel alienated at all is really going to be challenging to sort of eke out national level statewide victories. So that brings us to the sort of broader question that you ask about you know, the idea of developing a different conception of the nation. So this is incredibly challenging because this is really the sort of trillion-dollar question facing, you know, the social challenges of the United States. We need to adjust the idea of who we are. The question of who we are that is central to any country, any nation, it is basically our raison d'etre. It is central to people's loyalty and patriotism and the sacrifices that they make to the country, but also to the sense of solidarity and cohesion. And having a strong sense of that solidarity also makes people, you know, more willing to lose. No one wants to lose in a democracy, but you understand that the other side has the best interests of society in mind, and that, you know, it's not necessarily some kind of death sentence when they win. That goes away when the sense of we, who we are, is not universally felt. And so as the composition, demographically, as the composition of the country changes, who we are necessarily changes too. And so we have to, you know, rethink who we are, not necessarily in a way that, you know, alters the heritage of the country. We can certainly continue to revere it, but we have to somehow make space for newcomers and make them feel welcome and ensure that no one feels excluded, neither people who are native born here or people who are of recent immigrant origin. And that is really the needle that has to be threaded. We have to be inclusive, but also at the same time exclusive enough to make Americans continue to feel exceptional.
Justin Guest is our guest, majority minority. And that really is a tall order as we left your last words hanging in our minds. It's not easy. We have an impasse that's going on, a political stalemate. We've got legislative paralysis, as you point out, amidst the racialization of our politics and the politicization of American culture. I've never seen America as political as this. I remember an America where things were going along. Most people were somewhere wobbling around the middle, a little to the right, a little to the left. And I don't see that cohesion any longer. And amidst a sea of changes demographically.
Yeah, there's a number of trends that are driving this polarization and this sort of rush to the extremes. Our electoral institutions have a lot to do with it. The profit models of our media companies. But increasingly, I think that we cannot ignore the power of demographic shifts in making people feel like they belong. And I think what you're seeing on both sides of the aisle is a sense that when the other side wins, they feel like the country is not no longer theirs. And that is incredibly dangerous for any democracy.
Oh, absolutely. And here we have President Biden. He comes in and he talks about an America where, you know, nothing that America wants to do cannot be done. I've never seen us lose a challenge. We're all in this together. And then, of course, the reality of what he's facing, what America's facing in the face of majority minority impending and just on the horizon. And yet in many people's frame of thinking, it's already occurred. I mean, they're thinking, well, the minority groups are getting all the benefits, and I'm being pushed aside. My way of life in rural areas is being threatened, and I just don't see hope. And therefore, I feel that, you know, the more extreme I am, the more that I'm making my case, whether I'm voting in my own economic interests or not, I'm voting in my quote-unquote cultural interests. Take us through that progression.
Sure. So, you know, President Biden is in many ways trying to thread that very needle that I mentioned in my last comments. You know, he is, you know, clearly devoted his presidency and, you know, and himself to the unification of the country. He said as much in his inaugural on January 20th, 2021. He said that my whole heart, my whole soul is in it to chase this elusive unity that is so central to our democracy. And I think that, you know, it has been a learning process for President Biden. You know, this is not an easy challenge, and he's initially attempted to sort of come at it legislatively by focusing on consensus matters. You may, you know, remember, of course, all of his efforts to support the proliferation of the COVID vaccine, the effort to compensate people who are long-term unemployed, the parents' tax benefit for children. All of these were sort of kitchen table issues that the White House at that time believed would create a sort of consensus inside of America, things that everyone could kind of rally behind. And, you know, what he found, of course, was that the polarization of our politics was so strong that most Republicans, you know, simply weren't satisfied weren't satisfied with his actions, maybe not necessarily because they disliked the policy, but because they just disliked Democrats. And so even, you know, legislation was not actually bringing people together. And I think that's a lesson for all of us, is that, you know, you can't legislate unity. It's something that is so core to the country that we actually have to open people's ears. We have to create a sense of empathy. We have to listen to one another, tell stories, and really, you know, figure out just how much we have in common before we start to actually accept what the other side is doing. No one really cares about a president or a politician's, you know, 5-point policy proposal if they don't believe that you actually can be trusted with the future of the country, if they don't believe that you have them in mind. And I think that President Biden has a unique opportunity to do this because of his historic relationship with a lot of folks who are white Americans, white working class Americans, people who are more moderate. He has that relationship. He has a lot of trust with those folks. But at the same time, he is cognizant and connected to cross-pressuring, you know, forces of change. And so, you know, this is a really almost an impossible ask of one person to really undertake. And the reason why, of course, Larry, is that this is not something, you know, national unity, national unification, the redefinition of who we are. This is not a 4-year process that a single term president can actually manage, not even if President Biden were to win a second term. This is a, you know, 20, 30 year social challenge. It has to be something that all American presidents, that all Americans have their heart in. They all, like Joe Biden, have to put their soul into the challenge of reunifying the country and finding that we have more in common.
And how do we really do that? I mean, is it behavior that in terms of, you say it's not legislation, but there were many times when you think back to the 1960s when I grew up and you tried to affect the laws, the regulations, and hopefully you would change attitudes. Is it behavior or attitudes that have to first drive the debate? Because right now, with the media ecosystem, and back in the 60s, we didn't have this ecosystem where you went into your silo, your chamber, you listened only to those that you wanted to listen to, you drowned out and called fake news whatever you didn't agree with. And that makes it, to me, near impossible to do what you say is the greatest social challenge of our times, and that's to reimagine the disparate groups becoming some, you know, whole that they now are not, at least in the minds of one group versus another. They're really on opposite sides of virtually every debate. Even if they're not, they think they are, and they're being told that they are.
That's right, but we're not going to change the media ecosystem in the near term. We have to work within the structural constraints that we face. You know, we're not going to change, you know, broadly the sort of, you know, electoral institutions of the country. We have to work, you know, with, you know, what the defense is giving us effectively, as any football coach will tell you. So inside of that, those constraints, many people are lamenting the sort of persistence of racism or xenophobia in American society. And no doubt that is a scourge and something that we've been struggling with throughout the course of American history. However, what really changes countries over time in the course of my research, what I have found is actually governance and the way that institutions are managed, and also rhetoric and the way that the government set the tone. And in many ways, this is a sort of a ground game and an air game that complement each other. And on the ground, we need to encourage people and facilitate opportunities to interact with one another. We are more politically and racially segregated today than we were in 1990, according to some recent Harvard University research. We need to find ways to reconnect with one another, much in the way that you were describing the segregation of our news sources. We're segregated in who we have lunch with every day, in who we're talking on the phone with, you know, in who we actually are interacting with on a basketball court or in a music hall. So we need to actually create opportunities at a higher level for Americans to come together to break down the boundaries that separate us. And then rhetorically, we need leaders who are actually modeling the kind of behavior that reinvents the nation, that reimagines the nation, that normalizes interactions between people of different political backgrounds and different racial, ethnic, or religious backgrounds. And so that air game of norm setting and the ground game of interpersonal contact are really, I think, what's going to drive us forward if we are to make progress in the reimagination of who we are.
Justin, you do tell us, though, that nations that have undergone transformational demographic change have struggled to escape the gravitational pull of nationalism.
That's right. No one said this is easy. So, you know, I have mentioned a couple times now that this is the greatest social challenge of our era. And these kinds of social challenges aren't that great when they're easy to achieve. You know, this is going to be challenging. But there are different ways of leveraging nationalism. And not all nationalism has to be exclusive. Right now, we're in the throes of a very nationalist era in which nationalism is being used to other people of different backgrounds or of immigrant origin. And that's not a good way of leveraging nationalism, which is a very powerful sentiment in the American public and in lots of other countries. Rather, we can use nationalism, I think, in positive ways to invoke patriotism, to actually demonstrate how immigrants and people of racial and ethnic minorities are actually central to the national survival of the United States. Remember that almost all of our demographic growth is attributable to these current outgroups. So when you think about it that way, if you really want the country to endure, if you want to see the continuation, the persistence of American norms and American exceptionalism, we have to actually embrace those very people in the same logic of nationalism that we currently are othering them.
Yeah, I agree. And Ronald Reagan used to say that our secret sauce was bringing in new people, new ideas, immigrants. And I look at America today where we have shortages of workers, and I say we need more workers at the high end and the low end because we have an aging population and we don't have enough young people. There is this scarcity where there could be people butt in who want to do the work, and yet we're pushing them away. You talk about something called escape velocity, and you talk about taking that away from the tug of ethnic and religious affinities. Go into that briefly for us.
Sure. So escape velocity really just refers to the sort of counter force, which is the gravitational pull that is nationalism, the gravitational pull that is often a sense of alienation or exclusion. So people are so concerned, I think, with the longevity or the persistence of their ethnic and racial ties. And that is really a powerful sense of affinity. How do we build a nation, though, that is independent of who we are ethnically or racially or religiously, and try to make that nation more about who we are civically, that we can be a nation of laws, of norms, of progress, of dreams, of struggle, of persistence, of pride? You know, these are other ways of defining who we are beyond just what our blood quantum looks like. And if you think about it, you know, thinking in terms of ethnic or racial means is really quite primitive. You know, this is something that's earlier in the course of human history that many historians and philosophers thought that we would, you know, have shaken loose a long time ago. And yet there is this gravitational tug, almost like a magnetic energy of people back to these ethnic and racial roots. And maybe it's because, you know, of globalization, you know, the sort of blurring of borders in the course of global commerce, global migration, the global trade. But, you know, it nevertheless is taking place, and it's something that we're going to have to fight. But rather than resist the tug of nationalism, what the book argues is something from orbital dynamics, where you basically leverage the gravity of nationalism. It's an analogy from orbital dynamics. Where you leverage the power of nationalism and move it into a progressive direction, one in which you can actually facilitate greater inclusivity and greater pluralism. And I think that's what we have to do. Let's not deny the power of nationalism, but let's leverage it to a more inclusive and pluralistic society.
Well, one thing that worries me, I've got to be honest with you, Justin, is the response to the pandemic where we politicize that. I mean, if you thought that there might be a common enemy, and frankly, one that showed us who was on the front lines of our society as essential workers, I can't tell you how it became apparent to me how much racial minorities are delivering our goods, are there in our stores doing really important work, how many doctors are not from American roots, and yet they're doing the most important work on the front lines. And so if there was something that might have pulled us together, it should have been a pandemic. I hate to think we need a war to do that. But you do tell us that the impact of population decline, I mean, is something that, again, is really going to become more apparent, and we're going to have to do something about that. There's no way that we want to see that decline, which has happened from 2000 to 2010, to continue. But you say to break down ethnic and religious hierarchies that appropriate social, economic, and political advantage to certain identities, that you have got to, you know, you've got certain people trying to institutionalize, now folks, I want you to hear this, boundaries of temporary majority as boundaries of the enduring people. So while we're changing and shifting demographically, there are people trying to hold on to a past that no longer exists. And it's going to be a really tough pull out of that spiral, if you will, to make the change that is going to be required to make this the vibrant society that I think you and I hope for and envision.
Yeah, that's right. I think that I don't want to say that that past doesn't exist. You know, I think that the key here is to that any action, policy or otherwise, that we take, it has to reassure the people who look fondly upon that past, who value the sort of heritage of the United States, that they feel welcome and included in this country too. We cannot have a future where we turn the page from the people who used to make up the American majority to those who currently make it up. Because, you know, remember that white Americans, however you construe whiteness, which, you know, my book goes into a lot of detail about how that's changed over the years, but that white Americans, you know, are still going to make up the largest plurality, largest group in a majority-minority society. And secondly, that people of color, the ethnic and racial minorities, do not necessarily feel a sense of linked fate across them. There is no pan-minority sense of unity. And so, you know, or at least not one that is strong enough to sort of support an entire majority. And so, you know, in many ways, we have to make sure that everyone sees themselves in the American future, whether you are demographically in the ascendant or in the decline. And I think that's really important. You know, to your point around the pandemic, I was deeply, I mean, really profoundly disappointed in the response to the pandemic, in that this was an opportunity, as you say, to really come together as a country to fight a common scourge that really had a universal effect, that didn't discriminate across social or economic boundaries that, you know, in the day-to-day life of Americans, you know, we commonly see. But what we began to notice, of course, is that there was some discrimination, because some Americans were better positioned to actually avoid the kind of contact that led to contagion. But more importantly than that, I think, is it revealed the power of elite rhetoric. I lay so much of the divisiveness over the pandemic at the feet of the Trump administration White House, which decided that instead of trying to actually use this as an opportunity to unify the country in the way that Churchill used to say, don't let a good crisis go to waste, or never let a crisis go to waste, you know, that he could have actually brought the country together. And instead, he polarized us further. And to me, this was an enormous missed opportunity to actually bring the country into a sense of greater unity.
That is well said. And I would say this, he would have gotten reelected had he done that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It was politically suicidal as well, I think, in the end.
Justin Guest, G-E-S-T. Justin, you have really got us thinking here, and you've got to pick up this book, and you've got to start talking about these issues with others, people outside of your own sphere. And hopefully, with this podcast, certain people will at least be piqued in terms of their curiosity about what America looks like going forward. and how do we make this blend really work on behalf of all the American people, majority, minority. Justin, thank you for being with us today on America Trends.
It's my pleasure. Anytime.